a business like Netflix or Amazon Prime. Businesses where once a customer engages with them, it becomes automatic and a part of their lifestyle from then on. But how do you build that forever transaction? I'm Robbie Kelman Baxter, and I have been studying subscription and membership models for nearly 20 years. In this podcast, my guests and I share the secrets and strategies of the membership economy. Join us for Subscription Stories, True Tales from the Trenches. Budgets are tight, and competition to get and keep subscribers has never been more fierce. But what if I told you that there was a way to nudge your prospects and subscribers to help them engage more deeply and rapidly? It's possible, and today's guest, Nancy Harhut, has a wealth of easy and inexpensive tactics that can motivate your members to do the right thing at the right time. Nancy is the author of Using Behavioral Science in Marketing and Chief Creative Officer at HBT Marketing. In this special live episode, which was recorded at the Sub Summit Conference in Dallas, Texas, you'll learn how behavioral science can help you get more from your marketing spend, how to use tools like scarcity, social proof, and choice architecture to acquire, engage, and retain your subscribers, and the role of emotion on motivating subscribers to act. Before we dive in, though, I have a favor to ask. If you like the show, please take a minute to go over to Apple Podcasts or Apple iTunes and leave a review. Just a sentence or two makes all the difference. Thanks for your support. And without further ado, here's my conversation with Nancy. Nancy, welcome to the Subscription Stories podcast.
Robbie, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, this is a really fun recording because we're actually live at the Sub Summit in Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, I bet you that your listeners can feel the excitement and the vibe right now. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's so much fun. And you opened yesterday with the opening keynote talking about your book or the work from your book, Using Behavioral Science in Marketing. And so I wanted to just open up by asking, what is behavioral science?
Ah, that's a good question. And I'm glad that you asked it because when people hear behavioral science, sometimes I think science and their eyes roll back in their head. Other people think test tube and lab coats. But really, behavioral science is simply the study of how people behave, and more specifically, how they make decisions, why they do what they do. And that's what makes it so important for brands, for businesses, for marketers to understand. Because it turns out that very often people don't make decisions so much as default to decisions. They have these decision-making shortcuts that they rely on. And so when marketers understand that, we can get out ahead of it and make it more likely that people do what we want them to do.
Yeah. Science sometimes seems overwhelming, but even for startup entrepreneurs, some of these findings from behavioral science researchers can actually be pretty easily applied into their day-to-day marketing activities.
Absolutely. My philosophy is if you're going to put a marketing message out there, if you're going to put a message out to try to attract members or subscribers, you're doing it anyway. Why not take an extra couple of beats and do it in a way that's going to be optimized, that's going to make it more likely that people do what you want them to do? And some of the behavioral science behind the recommendations I give is really very easy to use. You know, it's changing one word over another. It's changing one phrase, choosing to say things slightly differently. You're conveying the same information, but how people receive that information can determine whether or not they say yes or they move on. And so you want to make it more likely they're going to say yes.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit more about how you got into behavioral science. But before I do, I would love for you to share a couple of examples of how, maybe even some of the examples from yesterday's talk about how subscriptions are using some of the tactics that you described in your book.
Sure. So when you think about it, we want to get people to sign up. We want to maybe cross-sell people. We want to retain people. And how we communicate with them is going to impact whether or not they do those things. So one of the examples I shared yesterday was something that I myself received. It was a company that does wine by the mail, and they wanted me to buy a bottle of wine. And of course, I like wine, so I'm like, oh, this looks good. But what they did is they used a really interesting technique called the endowment effect, because they told me that I had a $15 credit in my account that would expire at 11:59 tomorrow. And that's really very, very different than saying, hey, we're running a special. Buy a bottle by 11:59 tomorrow and we'll give you a $15 discount. Sure, mathematically it's the same thing, right? But the idea that the $15 credit was already in my account, well, that made me feel like it was mine, that I owned it. That triggers something called the endowment effect, which is basically this idea that we overvalue things that are ours. You know, if there's something we want to get, well, we value it. That's why we want to get it. But once it becomes ours, we place greater value on it. So I thought that was just a brilliant application. You know, it was like, hey, the $15 credit's in your account, but it's going to expire. And I went, it's my 15 bucks. I don't want to lose it. You know, so I was way more likely to use it than if they simply sent an email and said, here's a $15 discount, but you have to use it by a certain date. So I thought that was a really interesting example. There was another example that I showed that tapped into something called availability bias. And availability bias is the idea that people are going to judge the likelihood of an event happening based on how easily they can recall an example. So we're trying to get people to become our members, to become our subscribers. So they're going to judge the likelihood of an event. And in our case, the event is their need for what we're selling. Like, well, will I really need this? Would I be using it? They're going to judge that based on how easily they can recall a relevant example. So we want to get them to, before we ask them to buy, think of a time in the past when they'd be like, oh, man, if I only had been a member then, or if I had only subscribed then, it would have been so much better. Or we get them to imagine a time in the future when they could see themselves really benefiting from it. So FabFitFun had a social post, which I thought was very funny. They were trying to sell a digital luggage scale, and they spun this scenario, something like, you're at the airport, your luggage is overweight, you're frantically pulling pieces of clothing out of your suitcase and layering them on so that you look like the Michelin man as you're walking through TSA. It was funny. I've been that Michelin man, by the way. It's funny. When you read that, you either think of the time that that did happen to you, or you think of the time you were at the airport and you saw somebody else doing it, or you think of that time when you're at the airport and they say, please put your suitcase on the scale, and you sweat a little and you're like, oh, I really hope it's not overweight. So it just kind of brings you back there. And once you're in that mindset, then they talk about their digital luggage scale, and you're like, probably a pretty good idea. Whereas if they had just launched into it and said, hey, you should probably have a digital luggage scale before you go traveling next, you might say, I don't think I really need that. But when they spin it with this idea of like, oh my gosh, there's too much weight in your luggage, you're pulling stuff out, you're layering it on, it sets the stage or it lays the groundwork, and it just makes people way more receptive to the message. So those were a couple of the examples that I shared yesterday, and I think they're really good examples of how brands and marketers for those brands can use behavioral science. And again, it's not that difficult. It's just giving a little thought to your prospect or your prospective customer's mindset and thinking, all right, what might pave the way for my message?
Yeah, I love it. What I noticed in those two examples is that emotion is coming into play. Like, you started by saying, don't be afraid of science. It's not all test tubes and metrics. I mean, when you give the examples, it really comes to life. This is about impacting people and making them feel things that drive them to take action, right? Logic makes us think, emotion makes us act. How do you think about the role of emotion in building out, let's say, a subscription marketing communications plan?
Sure. You are spot on about emotion. Well, a lot of times we think that if we just give people the right information, they'll make the right decision, right? And sure, we do need to give them the right information. We need to talk about our product, our service, the particulars, the price. All of that has to be there. But the truth of the matter is, people make decisions for emotional reasons, and then they later justify the decisions with the rational reasons. Oh, the quality is good. The price was right. But before that happens, there's an emotional response. So we really need to think about what emotions we want to stoke in people. And some of them are obvious, like, all right, if you're selling fashion, it's like, oh, the joy of having some new clothes, or maybe you're selling food and the enjoyment there. But there are other ways that we can pull in emotion. For example, people really like to feel safe and confident. And if we can make people feel that way about subscribing, about becoming our member, that is going to be a very good thing to do. There's the idea of reciprocity. When somebody does something for us, whether or not we asked for it, but when somebody gives us something, we feel this need to reciprocate, to somehow even the score, to repay the debt. So when brands can give a little something in advance, kind of the give to get idea, maybe I asked for it, maybe I didn't, but I have this free guide or this free gift or this free sample, and now I feel obliged to maybe make a purchase to even the score. So this idea of feeling obligated can come into play.
It's so interesting that you say that. I just had an aha moment. That's why I do this podcast, by the way, so that I can learn from really smart guests. But I was thinking about free samples and how you go to Costco and they have all the different free samples and how they always knew that a free sample is a taste of something delicious so that you understand how good it is and believe them and then you buy it. But you're bringing up this other piece that I think is equally important in this moment, which is somebody was standing there by the samples. And so if you're offering me samples and I take one, I do feel an obligation now to do something for you. And the only thing I can do is buy it. So I'd never thought of that, that there's a reciprocity element that's involved in free samples.
Oh my God, I have a basement full of wine because I like to go to wine tastings. You taste a few wines and then I can't walk out without buying a bottle. And they were good, right? So you buy a bottle, it goes downstairs into the basement, and then I go the next week to a wine, and I'm not drinking them, and now I've got all these bottles of wine down there, and I finally had to quit the wine tastings because of that very reason. And they say, hey, it's wine tasting, you don't have to buy. But exactly what you described happens. You're standing there, you've had a few sips of something, and you feel like, I really should buy something. And you are nicely articulated the emotional, the rational, too, when you're talking about the free samples, because it's like, well, I'm going to taste this to make sure that it's as good as they say it is and to make sure I like it. That's very rational, right? But then the emotional part of it is, ooh, and now they just gave me something free and I should return the favor. So it's really very powerful. And a lot of times people aren't even aware of it. So that's another way that emotion comes into play. A third way is people like to feel special, right? We love to feel special. And if we can make our members and our customers and our prospects feel exclusive in some way, that's a wonderful thing. If I think that I'm getting a special offer because of who I am, maybe a group that I belong to, or because of some action that I took. Maybe I subscribed to your email or your newsletter or something, and as a result, I'm getting a special offer. I feel special. I feel like, ooh, or if I'm giving access to something or special perks that my friends and neighbors don't yet have, I love that. That's like psychological gold, right? It's very motivating. So people like to feel special. So it's another place where we can inject some emotion.
Yeah, and that's a great one for here at the conference because there's a whole room full of vendors downstairs. And I would imagine that if they had offers, this learning from you right now in real time and trying to think this through, if they had offers where they said, special offer for sub-summit attendees, good only until the end of sub-summit, that really puts those concepts, a couple of your concepts, into practice.
Absolutely. I could start with, Robbie, you are clearly a very successful business person. Not everybody is. So now you're excited.
That already works.
Right? Okay.
The exclusive flattery will get you everywhere.
Then I can say, and because of the business you're in, you could probably really use our services. And I've got this special that only runs through the end of sub-summit, and I'd like to offer it to you, and it's going to give you this discount. And you just package all those things in, and suddenly I'm feeling like I've been sought out and recognized, and I'm getting something that not everybody could get because I happen to be here. If I tossed in a little discount or a free sample or an upgrade or something like that, maybe even the reciprocity would kick in. You're like, oh my gosh, not only did they give me this show special, but they added to it because we were chatting and I kind of have to do something now. I've got to give them some business back.
Yeah, I love this. It's really interesting. And this emotional piece is important. It's really important, I think, in subscriptions. So you have 17 tactics that you talk about in your book, Using Behavioral Science in Marketing, and that's a lot, and they apply in different situations. And I'm wondering, should you decide which ones to use based on, do some work better or worse based on channel, like online versus in person, as we've discussed, by industry, the wine industry versus, let's say, professional services, insurance, or for the action you're trying to do, acquisition versus engagement versus retention? How should somebody think about these 17 different tactics?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's actually more than that. I have 17 chapters. I probably cover about 25 different tactics. And behavioral scientists have identified hundreds of them. So the question, well, which one do I use? That's a great question. And it has less to do with channel, because the truth of the matter is people are people. And we're hardwired to rely on these decision-making shortcuts. We just do. Sometimes we're aware of it. Oftentimes we're not. But we just rely on them. And so if I'm speaking with you face-to-face in a sales situation, if I'm emailing you, if I'm sending you a direct mail postcard, if I'm on the phone with you, it's almost immaterial. It's like channel agnostic that reciprocity is going to work or scarcity is going to work or exclusivity. People are just people. They're going to respond. And there may be certain tactics that you might want to pull out based on what you're selling. But really, there again, it depends on kind of the challenge in front of you. So the way we look at it is, A lot of times we think, all right, why should people do what I want them to do? Why should they subscribe? Why should they become a member? And that's great. We need to ask that. But the other question that often isn't asked that needs to be is, and why might they not? Right? So here's all the reasons somebody should do something, which is great. We need to have that. But we also need to think about, but also, why wouldn't they? And now that I start to think about why they might not want to do something, that's what starts to open the window into, now, which of these behavioral science tactics should I use? So, all right, got this great subscription service. People should sign up. They'd really enjoy it. I've targeted this properly. Why might they not? I mean, I know that they would be good market for it, and I know I have a good product, but maybe they won't because they don't know who I am, okay? So if that's the case, I might want to look at a few different behavioral science principles. I might want to look at social proof, for example. And social proof is the idea that when people aren't certain of what to do, they look to other people, particularly people like themselves, and they follow their lead. So if I'm like, all right, I've never heard of you and your subscription, but I'm reading these testimonials, for example, of all these people that seem a lot like me who have already subscribed, they're happy, I guess I will. Or another way we could look at things is we could look at the authority principle. Okay, I don't know you, I've never heard of you, but you've been endorsed by the American Dental Association, or you've been endorsed by Good Housekeeping, or you've been featured on NBC or Shark Tank. And it's like, oh, well, all right, it must be good because Shark Tank and NBC and Good Housekeeping and the ADA, they wouldn't be saying that you're good unless you were. So, you know, we look at it that way. But then again, why might you not want to do this? We might say, oh, the reason people might not want to is they think I'm too expensive. Well, in that case, we might look at other behavioral science principles, right? We might want to look at how we describe price. There's something called magnitude encoding process. And basically what that means is the amount of physical space that a price takes up suggests to people how big or small the actual price is. So say something's $100. You could write that as $100.00. That's $100, right? Or you could write it as $100. That's also $100. The first one takes up more physical space. The second one takes up less. The way the human brain works, the second one just feels smaller because it takes up less space. So we could think about how we want to express our prices, where on the page or screen we want them. The $100 in the upper left seems like a higher price than that same $100 in the lower left because it's lower on the page or lower on the screen. The other thing we can do is we can anchor it to something else. So we've all heard the cheaper than a cup of coffee. In fact, I used that yesterday in one of my presentations. But the reason that works is we all know what a cup of coffee costs. We don't know what this new subscription, this new box of the month, this new membership should cost. We have no idea. But if we peg it to, well, it's like a cup of coffee a day, you're like, oh, well, that I spend. So the real way to use these principles is to think about why somebody might hesitate, what might be holding them back, and then where can we leverage a behavioral science principle to overcome that barrier and make people feel like, yeah, I'm going to go for this.
So if somebody at SubSummit, there's a lot of entrepreneurs, many of them with nascent businesses, pretty small, just getting started. Would you advise them to like make a list of all of the different tactics that you, the 25 or so tactics you have in your book, and then think about the problem, then go through them and say which ones of these might work the best? Is that, I don't know, take a little bit of time to put together the template, or maybe you already have that, and then they would just go through. It would take, let's say, an hour to sort of talk it through, or maybe a little longer with their colleagues. But is that kind of the approach that you would recommend?
That could be a good way. I mean, we have a small agency and we're so familiar with these that we kind of have them memorized, but that's basically the process we go through. You know, it's like, what do we want somebody to do? Why might they not do it? What's the best way to overcome that? I've talked to people who have read my book and they have sticky notes all over the book. And every time they read something that they think might apply to them in their particular business, they just put a sticky note there or they highlight it. I've spoken to a couple of people who said they created their own little flashcards. Other people have put together exactly what you say, just a list. The book itself at the end of every chapter just has a quick recap and takeaways and bullet points of how to use. So even that would be easy enough. But I think the critical thing is trying to figure out why somebody isn't going to want to do what you want them to do. Now, that said, you'd ask me, would you use different tactics perhaps if you're trying to acquire someone versus retain them? And sometimes, yes. Sometimes, no. I mean, we talked about social proof and testimonials. You can use those for acquisition. You could also use them for retention, right? Just to keep reminding people that they made a good decision.
I just thought of an example because I was thinking the same thing, that social proof is for acquisition when you were giving that example. But I was thinking about our water utility. I live in California. Water utility tells you how much water you use compared to your neighbors. And that also is working for driving behavior change, right? That I'm going to be like, oh, I probably should get those timers. I should get the timers installed because then I can use my water in the morning when it's less likely to evaporate and I would use less. But that also works peer there's social proof and there's also sort of social pressure.
Yes, exactly. We have something similar. I'm from Massachusetts. We have something similar with the electric utilities. The interesting story behind that is they would send out these periodic mailings that said, here's how much you're using, here's what your most efficient neighbors are using, and here's what the average person is using. And you obviously wanted to be in that like very efficient phase. And when they first were doing it, what was happening is if you were using very little and most people were using more, the people who were using very little actually started to use more because it was like,
I'm a dope, right?
Well, it was like
from the only one that's conserving.
From a social, from a marketing perspective, it was a backfire. It was a social proof backfire because that's exactly what people's like, oh, other people are using more and I'm not. Like, I guess I should use more. So then what they did is they put a smiley face next to the people. It's like, you're using very little with a smiley face. And that reversed it. Then suddenly people who were using less, they saw the smiley face and they're like, I'm good. It didn't prompt them to use more. But you're absolutely right. Social proof, social norms. We're not really sure. I don't know. How much water should I be using? How much electricity should I be using? Then you get this report and you're like, oh, okay, good. So yeah, social proof can be powerful. The other thing about social proof is a lot of times we want those 5 stars, right? We want a 5-star review. And I'm no different. If you read my book, give me a 5-star review. I'd be very happy if you do. But there's research that says the optimum number is actually 4.2 to 4.7. This research came out of Northwestern University. And the reason they find 4.2 to 4.7 really ideal is if you have nothing but 5-star reviews, it's suspicious. And people are like, what's going on here? But 4.7, 4.5, it's like, okay, you can't please everybody, but it looks like the majority of the people are happy, right? And the same thing with testimonials. We all look for that glowing testimonial, you know? Nancy's the best thing since sliced bread. It's like, I want to use that. But what you really want in a testimonial is if you can find one of your members or your subscribers who starts at that place of skepticism, who says, I wasn't really sure that this was going to work for me. I wasn't really sure this was going to be worth the price. I thought to myself, is this going to be any bit better than this other one I've been using? But then I tried it, and wow, I absolutely love it. That is so much better of a testimonial because you're starting at that point of skepticism, which is basically where your prospect is. If you had already convinced them, they wouldn't be reading those testimonials. There's something in the back of their mind that's holding them back. And if you can find a testimonial where someone is acknowledging it, someone like me had that same hesitation. They kind of rolled the dice and gave it a try, and they were pleased. It makes me feel like, well, then I should do the same thing.
Yeah. And back to your original point about whatever tools you're going to use, you want to start by understanding what is the hesitancy or what is the problem that's going to prevent them from doing the behavior you want them to do. If you know what those are, here's all the reasons somebody, for example, won't subscribe. If you're thinking about the social proof, you might actually want to have at least one social proof point that ties back to each too expensive, don't believe it works, think that the thing I already have will solve the problem well enough. Why do I need one more hair product, for example? That would be a very good way to just systematically kind of shore up all the weaknesses, all the potential leaks in your bucket.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. You start to make that list and a lot of times at my agency, we look for the primary barrier and the secondary barrier. Number one reason someone might not want to do what we want them to do, and then the secondary one. And we figure if we can attack those two, we're in a good place. And if you're talking about like having that list of testimonials and having a testimonial that kind of addresses each of those points, or just having the kind of the, all right, if this group of people is hesitant for this reason, here's what I'm going to use. If this group of people is hesitant for this reason, here's what I'm going to use. You know, maybe in some cases you've got an established customer base, but then you're maybe moving to a new area and those people haven't heard of you. So they're going to require different messaging than the established base because they've already heard of you. So it's thinking about, yeah, why they might not do what you want them to do. And then maybe putting together that list and you just swap in things.
Yeah, it's so easy to think like, I can see why you do well as a consultant, because once I'm talking to you, I can start to see all the tactics and how to put them into effect. We focus mostly on acquisition strategies, I would love to dig in a little bit on how you can use these same principles for engagement, retention, and then expansion of the relationship or upsell or cross-sell. Because those are things I think that are really important in the world of subscriptions. Sometimes acquisition is the easiest part, and keeping that subscriber around is the tricky place.
Sure, sure. You know, it's interesting. I recently read a case study about Adobe, and Adobe has a suite of products that you subscribe to. So this is more of a B2B play, but it has to do with retention. So what was happening is I think they had like increased their prices a little bit, and so they saw a bit of an uptick in people calling to cancel, to unsubscribe, right? And usually, what do you do? What do you tell people to say on the phone when someone calls to unsubscribe? Oh, why are you unsubscribing? Why do you want to cancel your membership, right? Because, well, that's helpful. We want to find out because we think if there's a problem, maybe we can fix it or maybe we can address it in the future. And it's just always good to know why people are leaving. But they decided to flip the script. And instead, they asked people, why did you originally subscribe? So you're calling to say you want to unsubscribe. And I said, okay, I understand. You can tell me why you subscribed in the first place. And what that did is it reminded people of all the value that they were getting from the service. And it allowed them, it got them just under a 9% save rate, which is pretty good, right? I mean, it was 8.8 or so, you know. Those people would have been gone. And by just saying, well, why did you originally subscribe? Oh, well, and then maybe they stepped them down to a different plan or something. But it managed to keep the customer as opposed to letting them go. So asking people, instead of why do you want to leave, why did you originally come to us? That could be an interesting tactic. Another good way to...
Before you go further, I want to ask you, because Adobe is in the press, is in the media today, because yesterday the Federal Trade Commission sued them for making it really hard to cancel.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so it sounds like what you just described to me doesn't sound like those are not the issues that were mentioned in the lawsuit. But it brings me to a question that was on my mind when I knew I was going to get to interview you about ethics. Right. So if you are using tools to drive behavior the way you want, it implies that it might not be the behavior that the customer would have exhibited without your nudge or your push. And I think there's a question about ethics. Are you, as the FTC says, tricking and trapping people into subscribing? Or are these ethical, thoughtful ways of helping people to understand the value they're going to get, making it less abstract, making it more resonant with their own goals and challenges? So how do you think about that? Kind of where is the ethical line in this kind of powerful set of tools?
It's a great question, and it's one that a lot of behavioral scientists talk about. And I would like to think that your audience, your listening audience, are ethical, responsible, honest people. And I'd like to think that my customers are the same, my clients are the same. And the word is always, use this responsibly. Don't misuse it. Just like any other tactic or tool in your toolbox, when email first came out, like people would spam people. Now, a lot of us are a lot better about that. We don't do it. There are still some bad players who do, but we just know you shouldn't be spamming people. It's the same thing with some of this behavioral science. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. You should do it when it's truthful. Don't tell me there's only 5 left when you have a whole storeroom of them. But if you only have 5 left, well, for goodness sakes, do tell me, because I might want one of those and think I have plenty of time. But if there's only 5, please tell me. So it's a question of user intent, really, brand or marketer intent. Like, you want to be honest. You want to be ethical. You want to be responsible. You want to use these for good. And when you think about it, when you put a marketing message out there, whether it's acquisition or retention or cross-sell, upsell, some people are going to be like, yes, oh my gosh, yes, I want to subscribe, or yes, I want to upgrade. Like, this is perfect. It couldn't have come at a better time. And then there's going to be another group that's going to say, no way, no how, just, I would never do this. I'm not interested. Or if I were to do it, I would only do it with this other company. Like, this isn't going to happen. And then there's that great section in the middle. And those people could say yes, but they're busy and their attention is fractured and they're distracted. And in order to hope that they might say yes, you first have to capture their attention. You have to make sure that they understand your message. You have to make sure that they retain it. And you have to make it easy for them to respond to it. If you fail in any of those 4 places, you're going to lose them. But your competitor, who maybe does succeed in one of those 4 places, will get them. There's a good chance they're going to go somewhere. It's just a question of where. And that's where we, when we're trying to create our messages, we want to think about adding some behavioral science, because behavioral science tactics will make it more likely that someone will notice your message, understand it, remember it, and respond to it. But do it ethically, do it honestly, do it responsibly. Don't do anything you wouldn't do to your best friend or your mom. Like, just don't.
Yeah, there's a fabulous book called, and I'm trying to think of the one's name. I'll put it in the show notes. And it's called, Would You Do That to Your Mother? It's about marketing ethics, which I love. So we're coming kind of to the end of our conversation, and it's been fascinating. And as I've said before, I've gotten a lot out of this. What would you say is the most important takeaway for subscription pros? If there's one thing that they start doing or stop doing as a result of this podcast, what would that be?
I think if you had to boil it down to one thing, it would be just keep in mind that people don't make decisions the way we think they do. We often think if I get the right message to the right person at the right time, I'm going to get the right result. I just have to get the right information in someone's hands. And what we have to remember is very often there are other factors at play that influence people's decisions, and they may not even be aware of them, but they do play a role. And when we keep that at the top of our minds, it will remind us to add some behavioral science, to think about how we want to phrase something, to choose that right testimonial, to, before we send out a message, think, all right, I know why someone should do this, but let me also make sure I've added in the reasons that will address the barriers to why they might not want to do this. So I think if we just remember that people make decisions not the way we think they do, they need a little bit more information, a little bit more of a nudge or a prompt, that will go a long way to increasing the likelihood we get those subscribes, we get the retention, we get the cross-sell, we get the loyalty that we're looking for.
So take a step back before you dive in with your communication strategy and consider some of these principles. Okay, do you have time for a speed round? Are you up for doing a speed round?
I just broke out in a sweat, but yes, okay. Okay. Give it a try.
Okay, first subscription you ever had?
First subscription I ever had, I think it might have been like American Girl magazine, or maybe before that, Highlights, which my parents got for me. But
I loved Highlights. Favorite subscription you're using right now?
Hootsuite.
Hootsuite for scheduling your own social media. Favorite personal subscription?
Personal subscription? Psychology Today.
Okay, awesome. The bottle of wine that you bought with your $15 credit?
It was red, I can tell you that much. It was probably a Cabernet, and beyond that, I don't remember.
The last email you received that made you take action?
Email I received, my business partner sent me a piece of copy I had to review.
And a book that you're reading right now?
Book that I'm reading right now, The Truth About Pricing by Melina Palmer.
Awesome. Nancy Harhut, thank you so much for being a guest on Subscription Stories.
Thank you so much for having me, Robbie. I really enjoyed this.
That was Nancy Harhut, author of Using Behavioral Science in Marketing and Chief Creative Officer at HBT Marketing. For more about Nancy and about HBT Marketing, go to www.hbtmktg.com. And for more about Subscription Stories, as well as a transcript of my conversation with Nancy, go to robbiekelmanbaxter.com/podcast.